when we think about strategies in the United States about relating to that struggle, it has to be based on some conception or guesses or your best bet about how change will take place in South Africa. And we began to talk about that last night, if you remember, in terms of the question of where does hope lie. You can't just constantly talk about the oppressiveness of South Africa without saying, where is the struggle? And people do walk around using the number 42 or some comparable number, saying, the time is near, it will not last forever, hold on, the struggle is about to happen. And they do not believe the change will come about by the white people of South Africa getting converted. They do not believe that these are really important concepts, and I just need to report them to you, but they're very important in terms of how we decide how we will act. They do not place their hope in apartheid getting better. You cannot improve on apartheid. They do not place their hope in that white South African government becoming tolerable, but rather, the events of the last few years have indicated also how the growing alienation from any conceptualization that they place their hope in the white government becoming better. And when the white government relates internationally, and when they get too much international pressure on them, they say, we'll make a few improvements and give the impression of the white government becoming better. And we get fooled into thinking so easily that, aha, change is taking place, and if we push harder, change will take place that way. The people of South Africa say it in ways so much better than I can, and some of them put it in almost a very mild kind of way, but you have to hear underneath the power of what they're saying when they say, we have long passed the point where token change can be tolerable. And there will be nothing less than the dismantling of this government and the rebuilding of a totally new government based on the representation of all peoples, a non-racial government that includes black and white, that they will not be satisfied with less. And so you hear of the increasing intensity of the struggle in South Africa. Just to go back, for example, 4 years ago from last Monday, June the 16th, 1976, was the day of the Great Soweto Uprising and was the mark of the new and probably one will not end back in the early 60s, 1960, the Sharpeville Uprising and the massacre that took place smashed it down again. And for 16 years, it lay dormant and underground again. And the Soweto Uprising, in which there were somewhere between 800 and 1,000 killed within 2 weeks, in June 16th, 1976, when the great slaughter took place, it was the indication, as a friend of mine from South Africa says, he said, you can see now there is not fear any longer. There is the standing in front of the guns and saying, you may shoot me, but you will lose. Where in the Sharpeville incident, it was the absolute driving of people underground again. And so the Soweto Uprising in 76 was extremely significant. It came in the middle of the new black consciousness movement, which is one of the most important persons involved in that was a man called Steve Biko, who was killed by the police while I was in South Africa in 1977. In September, and I attended his funeral, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. However, that the Black Consciousness Movement, the Steve Biko assassination, the continued determination that is being shown, and then you must have heard about 3 weeks ago of the Sasol plants being destroyed by guerrillas. It's interesting because we're going to make the transition with this about to U.S. involvement. The Sasol plants, the three of them were blown up. Is that right? I don't remember. They are plants for the converting of coal into gas. The Achilles heel of South Africa is that it has no oil, absolutely no oil. They are totally dependent on fossil fuels, energy fuels other than coal, from the outside. If anyone talks about the eventual necessity of creating sanctions and embargoes on South Africa, as happened with Rhodesia, it will be primarily around the coal industry, the oil industry. South Africa knows that and now has up to 3 years worth of oil in underground abandoned mines saved up. However, they place their biggest hope in developing the process for converting coal into gas. And the entire process being developed by, propane, energy gas, yes. I'm not technically understanding of that, but the replacement for oil imports and energy, propane, so forth. The entire process for this conversion, it's a very new thing. It's right on, it's never been done before. It's in the edge of the new technological creativity. We were talking about the other night about technology being used for good or for evil. That entire process is being developed by an American firm from Los Angeles in South Africa. We, our people, our industry, protected by the United States government, is in South Africa taking care of their Achilles heel and providing them from some other means of survival. And it's extremely important that we become aware of those connections that none of us want, but and the area where we have to, I think, to be most struggling about our influence in South Africa. Okay, one other thing about change taking place, then I'll make the transition to the United States, and that is, and I'll only say a few words about this because I'll be giving a full hour's talk on this on Monday, and that is the church's participation in the resistance by developing their theological understanding. We talked last night about how the Dutch Reformed Church historically has created a theological understanding of the South African apartheid system of being the will of God. The resisting churches, the black churches and the South Africa Council of Churches, which is a black and white organization, which is very strongly anti-apartheid and living on the edge of risk every day of their lives, have been theologically, since the early 1970s, trying to develop Christian understandings of resistance and have come up with theological understandings, especially in the Black Lutheran Church, of something called, and we'll be talking more about this especially on Monday, a Latin word called status confessionis, and I'll show you some specific things on that in a few moments. They began by in a conference in Swakopmund, a little town on the coast of Namibia. In 1975, the South African Council of Churches, which includes the Namibian and the South African churches, had a conference in which they began to develop the concept of obligatory resistance, that it's not just a question of Christians on both sides. And the best thing I can to introduce and to make a comparison, the most important comparison would be the Confessing Church in Germany. When the Confessing Church came out of the Confessing Church movement, became actually a split church, and it became a matter of a mark of what it means to be a Christian, to resist totally the Nazi government, while the major church of Germany had made its peace, its concordat with Hitler. While the major churches of the white government of South Africa have made its peace and actually become the foundation for the South African system of apartheid, the black churches have been developing a theological understanding and comparing it a lot to the German church and comparing it a lot to the pinch of incense. And I want to really begin to get that on Monday on the start when I speak on the concept of confessing church and status confessionis, that it becomes a mark of a Christian to publicly and unequivocally reject the apartheid system. We're living through a time now when that's just being developed. In 1977, the delegates of the South African churches who came to the Lutheran World Federation meeting in Dar es Salaam of the Lutheran World Federation Assembly came with a request that the Lutheran World Federation recognize that a situation of status confessionis, to be in a state of confession, that where it becomes an obligation of a Christian to resist and take a stand against a particular system, that the Lutheran World Federation recognized that a situation of a state of confession exists in South Africa. And the Lutheran World Federation did pass that, and in a few moments I'll be passing out to you the wording of that, because as I said when we began last night, it's not only because it's constitutionally required to be apartheid in South Africa, but also because it's theologically defended, that we need to both understand that our resistance to the apartheid system and to the United States' support of the apartheid system comes from not only our political sense of justice, but also from our sense of what it means to be Christians and our confession of what it means to be Christian. Okay, let me make a switch and talk about the South Bronx, South Africa connection. Does anybody, in making that, before I make that change, is there anything that are part of the status confessionis? Not yet. As you'll see when you read it in a few moments, the Lutheran World Federation actually made its declaration or its recognition of status confessionis by a request that the white churches of Southern Africa recognize that a state of confession exists there. And so far, nobody's answered their letters. That was in 1977. In 1978, 1979, last year, when the Lutheran World Federation's executive committee met in Brazil, they noted that not one white church had responded so far, and so the executive committee of the Lutheran World Federation sent letters to each of the, I think, six white churches, saying, maybe you didn't get our letter, would you like to respond? And I have no idea what's happened since then. It's current happening, whether or not the white churches will respond to that, and what the Lutheran World Federation does if they don't, whether it's primarily the black Lutheran churches with some white individuals supporting them who have been about the business of trying to put in words theological concepts, the requirement, the obligation of a Christian to resist. And the question now is whether or not the white churches will respond to that declaration. Did you hear? Could you hear in the back? She's saying she remembered Pastor Will Hertzfeld, who's an AELC black pastor from Oakland and vice president of the AELC nationally, was in Dar es Salaam. We were there together, it was his reporting on that you remember, his being very filled with emotion about that, and the connections are. That also were important to him and should be to all of us, and that's what I want to report on, is the connection of what status confessionis has to do with us and not just with the white churches of Southern Africa. So I want to come to that in a moment.
You said there are some white individuals involved in the status confessionis?
Yes.
They're not been able yet to transfer that into the white churches?
Yes. For the most part, they're alienated from the white churches and participate more in the South African Council of Churches. One of the primary persons being the director of the Department of Justice and Reconciliation of the South African Council of Churches is a Lutheran theologian by the name of Wolfram Kistner, and a very close friend of mine, one of my great heroes, and he has been leading not only in the helping of the defining of status confessionis for the Lutherans, but also in the transferring that ecumenically into the question of obligatory resistance for all Christians. I don't want to get too deeply into it today, but the status confessionis concept comes out of our own Augsburg Confession and the Formula of Concord, rather. And I'm really excited on the 450th anniversary that the Formula of Concord and the Augsburg Confession are finally used to get us into trouble rather than out of it. Yes, all of the white Lutheran church, they're very small, and I think there are six, there may be five, I don't have my facts down about that, of the white Lutheran churches are not missionary churches. They are national, they're made up of people who primarily German, who came in immigration partly as missionary movements, but they are primarily white national churches. Yes, yes. They're the people who, some of whom I met, and brag openly that they are more supportive of the system than the Dutch Reformed Church. I can get into too much emotional verbal attack of them if I talk about them too much. I feel very strong. I've been taught to feel very strongly by some white people in South Africa who've been forced out of those churches because they stand for justice, and who describe, when is Hitler's birthday? 15th of April? 17th of April? I'm sure nobody knows that. But it's one of the major holidays of the white Lutherans in South Africa. Not officially in the church, but of white Lutherans and white German nationals, ex-German nationals who've moved to South Africa. So it's really, there's a lot of sickness there. Just a couple more questions, we've got to move on. You had your hand up first. Oh yes, yeah, and they're having to constantly look over their shoulders, not just simply at their own.
I mean, the black women that are being assassinated, and I would imagine the white women.
There's a number of people that I met and became friends with in the 4 month time I was there who are now dead. Opened the door to the bell ringing at 1 o'clock and a shotgun blows them away. That kind of a thing is happening all the time. When I go into a situation like that, I always look for, as I do in the United States, because I think the question is, how do white people resist racism? And our own people's racism. So I've made a special effort to understand and build an allied relationship with white people who are standing in resistance in South Africa. And it's an exciting thing to find people like that. Virtually no integrated congregations in South Africa. Up until recently, it was illegal, and so any integration of a worship service was illegal, and it was still done at times. Pardon? Yeah, in the last 10 years or so. Within about 4 years, I think it's been, no, even less than that, the South African government has now passed a law saying they may come together for worship if they apply for a permit. And no church, as far as I know, no church has applied for a permit because they said, we don't recognize your right to have kept us apart. We're not going to give you the right to give us the permission to come together. But there are, for example, like the Anglican Cathedral in downtown Johannesburg is a beautifully integrated worship service every Sunday. But there are virtually no, other than that, there are no, except for tiny little witnessing congregations, there are virtually no integrated congregations. It's because they're forced apart by the system. You know, it's like in many areas where we live, we open up our doors and say, blacks can come in anytime we want to, or gee, we really want them, but our system has already structured it so that the blacks already live 30 miles away. And so the desire for having a multiracial congregation in our congregations is limited by the systemic separation. And in South Africa, the legally systemic separation, which is why status confessionis, as I want to keep wanting to go over into that, and I want to talk about it Monday more than today, but calls for opposing the system and not just simply the rules that say you may not commune together, because now the rules are you can commune together if you ask for a permit, but rather the system prevents it from happening. Primarily the Dutch Reformed Church.
And don't they consider
themselves Christians? Yes, yes.
How can they be in this system?
That one of the main, as we discussed at length last night, that one of the main marks of the South African system, which makes it very unique, is a deep Christian belief that God has sent them there. Jesus died to make that possible. They are called people of God, bringing the light of white civilization to darkest Africa. Okay, I'm going to make a transition. I realize that we could talk for a long, long time just about South Africa and need to, but I think we have an even greater necessity to make the connections to bring it home, because it's so easy to just feel badly, and we should, about what's happening there. But if we really want to be doing something that doesn't make it sort of another foreign missionary project to set black South Africans free, we need to deal with our own involvement in it and our own imprisonment, and how we have to be struggling in the United States for our connections to South Africa. I mentioned last night that when people visit me from Soweto and come to the South Bronx to where I live, and by the way, in the film last night of Dom Elder, of Excuse Me America, after they showed Brazil and they began immediately to switch to the United States, and the first views you saw were a bunch of burned out buildings in the United States, that was my home. That was one block from where I live. That's the South Bronx. It looks like Germany after the fire. And the South Bronx South Africa connection makes people come from Soweto and come to the South Bronx and say, "Oh, I see the difference. Your Soweto is inside the city." And that's about as far as the separations go. Which is to say that for me, after I came home from South Africa from a brief but very intense 4 months there, that one of the feelings I had more than anything else is that I had not been in a foreign land where I'd seen something I had never seen before, but rather I had seen something that was an exaggerated stereotype of what we have in the United States. It's like going into a fun house, you know, and you get one of those curved mirrors that make you look fat or thin, and you're not sure it's you, but you stick out your right hand, and the right hand goes out, so you know it must have been you, you know, even though it's barely recognizable. South Africa is an exaggeration, an awful, demonic exaggeration of us, but only an exaggeration. And the seeds of what are there are directly connected with the seeds of what are here. In fact, the history of South Africa is exactly and directly proportionally parallel with ours. The settlers came to Cape Town. They had a great frontier expansion. If I had the record, and I wanted to take it out of South Africa, but nobody could give it to me, and I still haven't found it in the United States, there is a recording that was made of Robert Kennedy in 1964 or 1965, I believe it was, making a speech at the University of Cape Town to students and faculty there. And for the first 5 minutes of his speech, or about 3 minutes, I think it was, he said something like this: I'm happy to be here tonight because of my deep love and respect for our country." And then he went on to say things that I'll say in a second, but the whole time the South African people listening thought he was talking about South Africa. He said, I'm here tonight out of my deep love and respect for a country that was first settled by the Dutch, that fought a war of a colonial war with the English, that had trouble with the natives from the first moment it reached the shore, that still has incredible hostile relationships with the blacks in its borders, that had a frontier expansion, and he named the dates, at the end of which gold was discovered and changed the whole history, and on, describing the Conestoga wagons and everything like that. And when he got through, and just absolutely astounded the South African people when he said, "Of course I'm talking about the United States of America," and describing the slaughtering of the people and the moving of them into reservations and so forth. The parallels are incredible. And so it is not at all a distortion to say that is an exaggerated stereotype of us, and that connections need to be seen that way, not just another set of evils out there someplace. In many ways, South Africa is also a stereotype of the whole third world, of a small, white, rich population living off of the backs of a non-white majority, can be also very clearly be a description of what the whole world looks like, of a very, very rich, small minority of predominantly white Western people living in a directly related to our riches being dependent upon the poverty of the colored majorities of the world. Well, that's by way of just an introduction to say that the connecting South Africa and the United States is not just not a distant one. To make it more specific about South Africa, however, there are four nations whose investments and industrial support for South Africa make it possible for that white government to continue. That white government is heavily dependent upon external investments and loans. The four countries are England, Germany, Japan, and the United States. This is for sale in the library, in the bookstore up there, and I just want you to see it. Church Investment in Southern Africa, it deals specifically with investments of churches in the United States, such as the LCA and the ALC, in corporations that are in Southern Africa. But it also gives the detailed recording, as well as another folder I have here that anybody wants to look at it, which gives a detailed list of the corporations and the amount of money invested in Southern Africa by the United States. It's extremely important, I think, to recognize that through bank loans, through corporate presence of multinational corporations, through military support, and through governmental support, the United States lives in a very schizophrenic relationship to South Africa, where all of our principles and underlying assumptions about freedom, on the one hand, make us identify very deeply with the struggle of the black people in South Africa for freedom, that all of the economic involvements and political involvements and military involvements make the exact opposite come true. That politically, economically, militarily, and industrially, our country is systemically on the side of white South Africa and supports it. With deep concern about that, as I'll talk about in a few moments, and trying to say how can we use those investments to improve conditions, but not with recognition that it is actually those conditions which helps to keep South Africa alive. Since 1963, it has been technically illegal for the United States. The United States Congress made it illegal in 1963 to sell military equipment and weapons to South Africa. And so officially and militarily, we have not been supporting South Africa in that way since 1963. However, Israel is presently the largest supplier of arms to South Africa. That's very ironic, I know. They were also one of the largest suppliers of weapons to the Somoza government in Nicaragua before it fell. We are one of the largest suppliers to Israel of weapons. And so that it just means that it goes through a middleman. Also, there have been times when the illegal shipments directly from the United States through other countries of weapons from the United States have taken place and have been discovered. Maybe even more important, do you remember back in World War II, those of you who were around, or those of you who read your history book, that during World War II, there was a law, I don't remember the name of it, I have to look it up so I can make the speech better, there was a law that took away the definition between public and private ownership of goods that are needed by the military. That any time the military needed something in the United States to support the war effort, they could just go to a private concern and confiscate it or buy it at cost. Do you remember that? Do you remember the name of that law? It has a name. That law was never revoked in South Africa. And there still exists today the right of the military at any time to take anything needed from the corporations, General Motors, Ford, Firestone, whatever, to supply the military. So all the laws we have in the world don't change the fact that the South African government and its military makes direct use of all of our corporate investments in South Africa. And in some cases, in the contracts that are signed with the corporations that come to South Africa, there is a requirement that certain percentages of each annual production be sold at cost to the military. So all of those clean-cut definitions of saying, but we don't supply the military anymore, have absolutely nothing to do with the reality that's there. Since we're short of time, I want to tell a story rather than going to long descriptions of how that gets carried out and how that mixed message comes across to South Africa. And it's a very emotional story to me, and it probably can be accused of being an oversimplification of reality, but you can take it as that and then listen to the story. On September 25th, 1977, I rode with a car with a man by the name of Beyers Naudé, who is now under house arrest in South Africa, and his wife, and a Swedish journalist, on an eight-hour trip from Johannesburg to Port Elizabeth to attend the funeral of Steve Biko. And another, by the way, parenthetically, another great parallel, incredible parallel between the United States and South Africa. I've attended many funerals in the United States in the 60s of black people killed by the police in the United States. And then, of course, the main funeral was was that of Dr. Martin Luther King, but many, many other funerals. And going to Steve Biko's funeral was such a visitation of something that had already happened in my life and the connections between the United States and South Africa that it was. It took me a long time to recover from it. About 50,000 black people came to that funeral and they just came from around the Port Elizabeth area because all the buses that tried to get through to the funeral were smashed and many people killed by the South African police, not letting them get to Steve Biko's funeral. About 50,000 people attended that funeral, and about 50 white people. And except for the few of us that were like Beyers Naudé and his wife and myself, most of the white people who attended were officials of European and North American governments who came as a show of solidarity with the black people and in protest for their having killed their Martin Luther King, if you will. And at that funeral, the United States and the European countries had the image and gave the message of being on the side of the black people. The American ambassador came with, you know how the diplomats are, they came with their flag at half-mast on their car, big Cadillac. Andy Young sent a big, massive wreath to lay on the casket of Steve Biko. The speeches that were made, the presence of those white people made it impossible for the military of South Africa to break up the funeral, and so it was a peaceful funeral. It was in the context of an Anglican mass, and 10 Anglican priests, black Anglican priests from all over South Africa conducted the mass, and then 19 speeches were made by black South Africans in the struggle. Most of those black South Africans are either dead or in jail or in exile right now. At any rate, but the image and the message was the support and the identification of white European and North American government with the black struggle for liberation. The next day, on September 26th, and for this reason we had to quickly get in the car and drive back to Johannesburg to catch another meeting, which we couldn't get into, but the Swedish journalist could, and he taped it for us. It was a meeting in the Carlton Hotel, the most expensive and lavish, luxurious hotel in Johannesburg, of the American branch of the South African Chamber of Commerce. It was 500 white American businessmen representing American business in South Africa, representing all those multinational corporations that are present in South Africa. The Prime Minister then was not the present man whose name is Botha, it was Forster, and up until last year he was the Prime Minister of South Africa. And he spoke to the Chamber of Commerce for 35 minutes to the white American businessmen who were the American branch of the South African Chamber of Commerce. And for 35 minutes, he attacked all those who were present at that funeral the day before. He vilified any nation that would interfere with South African politics and anyone who would even suggest that the police had murdered Steve Biko. And he absolutely just attacked anyone who would interfere with South African politics. Then he went on to promise those businessmen that their investments would be safe and secure, and their profits, ranging from 17% to 20%, would continue to be that high so long as he was able to defend and maintain those four legs of the apartheid system that I described yesterday, the segregation system, the job reservation system, the migrant law labor system, and the homeland policy. So long as he was able to keep those four legs standing, that he would promised them that their investments would be secure and their profits would remain high. During that 35-minute speech, he was repeatedly interrupted with applause and in the end given a 5-minute standing ovation. At the very least, you can conclude from that the mixed message we are giving to South Africa. The mixed message that the black people have about whose side are we on. And you can also get from that the confusion about who is controlling American policy about our involvement in South Africa. And the problem that we face, as we were talking about yesterday, of our heavy dependence upon such governments as South Africa in order that we can get the minerals and the uranium and the gold and diamonds and whatever other riches and resources and labor, cheap labor, and in the process of our upholding systems of oppression such as South Africa, and the confusion and the conflict that we have to face between the freedom that we as Americans believe in and the difficulty of our being able to live that out because of what is taking place. Now, I'd like to turn from that to the subject of... Sure. Yes. Yes, no, they were American citizens representing... They were the heads of the American firms. There are 350-some American firms in South Africa that are extensions of multinational corporations that are based in the United States. These are Americans who are heads of American firms that are in South Africa. Yeah. There's only one international newspaper that carried that story, and that was the Swedish newspaper that my journalist friend was reporting from. Are there any other questions before I want to turn into the what do we do as Americans in the English speaking ones, yes.
I'm certain then that American business, also being very perceptive, realizes that's the case also. And 10 years down the road, I'm just saying 10 years theoretically, that the situation is going to be reversed and they're going to have to deal with these black actors. At what point, and maybe just three, that's a big question, at what point will these American businesses transfer that authority, their allegiance from the white to the black, or are they just going to, obviously seeing the handwriting on the wall, continue to play the game until they're just going to write it off?
That's a very complicated question that requires, to answer it well, a background contextualizing of how the end of colonialism came to the rest of Africa. How neo-colonialism began, and how, in many cases, the waiting until the last minute was a successful economic policy, and because the turning over of the colony to independent political leadership only required then a new way of getting economic footholds and continuing on the same profit-making basis. That's true in countries such as Zaire, especially. I don't know the answer to that. It seems to me that any sensible, and I've heard some business people talk this way, and some bankers talk this way, that we're reaching the point where risk, it's already getting too risky for us and to invest. But I also know that many multinational corporations already have written in to their profit-loss columns the loss of that which they had there when it gets taken from them. No, that's really important. The people who lead the black liberation movements, the black consciousness movement, and so forth, have very, very clear that of their desire to build a non-racial government, a non-racist government, and one that has international relationships. Whether or not our corporation leaders will believe that and will participate in that, to what degree they will, is still be seen. I guess I would. I'm not sure I'd say it exactly that way, but I don't think that would be inaccurate to put it that way. I think we also though need to look at situations like it, like is happening now in Zimbabwe, of a of the possibility of transition, of building governments that are that are not fulfilling the white fear of they will do to us what we did to them, and really do seek to build a kind of a just system that does include international relationships in the press and recognizes the need for the international technological skills for the building of a new nation. I want to read a quote as way of getting a by way of making a transition from the man whose name I mentioned earlier, of Wolfram Kissner, who has visited the United States several times, and some of you here in the room know him, and who's helped me a lot and helped a lot of other people to answer the question of what's the responsibility of Christians in the United States, not only in terms of our supporting and being in solidarity with South Africa, but our being able to understand that we have connections here, and it's not just supporting their struggle, but our need to struggle here for justice. And this is a quote from him, and it says, and I think one of the things I'm going to hand out has it written on also. It says that Christians and churches in overseas countries can, in the long run, not contribute towards justice in human relationships in South Africa as long as they are not willing to oppose the forces at work in their own political order that uphold the impoverishment and oppression of people in South Africa and in other countries, especially the so-called Third World. Justice and reconciliation in Southern Africa cannot be achieved as long as other societies or groups in other societies profit from the exploitation and suffering of people in the Republic of South Africa. Justice and freedom and reconciliation in the different countries are interdependent and indivisible. And then in further conversations that came from that kind of a discussion, it was the conclusion it can be concluded to begin from what it means to be a Christian, that the question of being in status confessionis, that is, to publicly and unequivocally reject the apartheid system, is not only a requirement of people who live in Southern Africa, but people who live in other countries who are Christians in the rest of the world, especially those countries whose nations participate in keeping that South African system alive. And so the first basis for judging whether or not a person how a person will work for change needs to be on the basis of the fact that we are in solidarity with the people, with Christians in South Africa, who have declared that it is that kind of situation, and ask us to be also declaring, recognizing that situation, and declaring ourselves ready to publicly and unequivocally, and they're the words I'm going to pass out, publicly and unequivocally reject the apartheid system. You want to just let me come to that. That's what I want to get into. The issue, both because we need an issue to focus on working for change, as well as the fact that it's one of the major issues before the Lutheran Church and the AL and the American Lutheran Church today in relationship to South Africa, is the one that he has raised. Will we continue to invest in corporations that are in South Africa with our pension money and other investment funds, or will we disinvest? And that's the issues that are going to be voted on as questions at the LCA convention next week and at the ALC convention in October in Minneapolis. And those of you who attended synod or district conventions know that for most part that question has been raised in almost every synod and district convention over the last 3 months. The both churches invest approximately one-third of our funds, of our investment funds are invested in corporations that are in South Africa, that are also in South Africa, not only in South Africa. Up until now, it has been the policies of the churches to keep invested in those corporations and to try and use our votes at stockholder meetings to influence the policies of corporations to act better, to have better relationships with their black employees. The work of the Lutheran Coalition on Southern Africa, with which I work and which produced that folder you're holding, is a group that's calling for total disinvestment from funds and corporations, and a deeper participation in the bank withdrawal campaign that is pressuring banks to stop loaning monies to South Africa. I'll try and answer that question. I hope I can do it adequately in the time remaining for a discussion. In the second page inside your bulletin, inside that square, is the Status Confessionis statement. Under normal circumstances, Christians may have different opinions in political questions. However, political and social systems might become perverted and oppressive so that it is consistent with the Augsburg Confession to reject them and to work for change. We especially appeal to our white member churches in Southern Africa to recognize that the situation in Southern Africa constitutes a status confessionis. This means that on the basis of faith and in order to manifest the unity of the church, churches would publicly and unequivocally reject the existing apartheid system. So the first stage of the voting that has taken place in synods and districts and will be taking place in the national conventions is changing the wording on that slightly so that it reads, we of the Lutheran Church in America or of the American Lutheran Church recognize that a situation of status confessionis exists in South Africa. This means that on the basis of faith and in order to manifest the unity of the church, the Lutheran Church in America publicly and unequivocally rejects the existing apartheid system. Now, we're going to talk about that theologically in more depth on Monday. However, this would mean, to me at least, and you can debate this if you like, that the first question that's asked in the disinvestment question has changed radically the way one approaches it when a sister church, our sisters and brothers in South Africa who are Christians, have declared that their situation has crossed the border of personal choice of whether you support that system or not, and that it's a mark of a Christian to publicly and unequivocally reject it, and that this then changes qualitatively and quantitatively how we approach the apartheid, the disinvestment question. That it's no longer just a question of the most effective means of influencing a country to be more just, or a corporation to be more just, but it's an act of solidarity with the people in South Africa about how we disassociate ourselves, how we publicly and unequivocally, as an act of worship, as Dan described in his Bible study, to choose between Christ or Caesar, as an act of worship, disassociate ourselves from that system, as the South African people speak of obligatory resistance. Now that's the first question. Just as the South African system defends itself in religious terms, that the first question for us to ask ourselves is that in the light of the theological proclamation that we are in a state of confession in the name of the unity of Christ that calls us to act in ways which call for unity in Christ by publicly and unequivocally rejecting that which separates us, we have to place that as the first dimension of asking the question about investments or of any other way in which we as a people, as a church or as a nation, relate to the South African system. I would, however, just make one qualifying statement about that. I personally believe that there ought to be total corporate exit from South Africa, sanctions, embargoes. However, this particular question we're raising now is only whether or not the church, as Christians, invests in those corporations. Our own, as the title of this was called in South Africa, in Tanzania, at the LWF meeting originally, it was called a statement of confessional integrity. In order for us to have our confessional integrity as Christians, do we or do we not invest in that, in those corporations? So the first question is one of confessional integrity. The second question for judging that is directly related to the issue you've raised about what is the most effective thing we can do to influence justice in South Africa. And then we have to go back and ask the question we started to ask last night and I mentioned at the very beginning this morning. And that is the question of how do we expect change, justice, to come to South Africa? The black South Africans that I spent many hours with, and many white South Africans also, you know, spent a lot of time trying to get it through my thick skull that they do not expect change to come about because white corporations or white South African government have been convinced to be nice, to be more just, to make the situation more tolerable. The assumption that is made by maintaining investments and trying to influence corporations to treat their workers better is that they can make the apartheid system more tolerable, nicer to the black people. And I think that the distinction becomes very clear there. I try and use it's a dramatic illustration, but I think it's accurate. If we were a church meeting in 1780 rather than 1980, and we had investments in the cotton gin concession on a slave farm in southern part of the United States, would we? Maybe make it a little closer to the time of freedom. That's almost a century away. Say something like 1830 or 1840 or 1850, with the question of the abolition of slavery right on our doorsteps, of how will change come about for the slaves of the United States. Would we say, let us stay invested in the cotton gin concession of the slave farms of southern United States in order that we can not only continue our profit, but that we can also use that investment to try and influence the cotton gin concessionaire to treat his slaves better as our way of dealing with the question of justice for slaves? Or would we be able to guess, bet, place our bets, place our risks, place our lives, our commitment to Christ, whatever, that change of that nature is intolerable, and that the only possible answer to justice is that of the ending of the slave system? The influence by stocks is directly related to something called the Sullivan Principles, trying to get corporations in South Africa to sign something called the Sullivan Principles. There are six principles for treating black workers better. Non-segregated toilets, better lunch counters, better promotional systems, better training. All of them have to do with white people treating black people better. None of the principles of improving corporate relations in South Africa have anything to do with black empowerment. South Africa wouldn't allow it. It would be illegal. The question that needs to be asked in terms of not only status confessionis, being publicly and unequivocally rejecting the apartheid system, but also in terms of what's the most effective way of our working for change in the United States and our support of that in the United States, is how you expect change to come about. I had one black person say to me, the way we make a distinction between a liberal, and liberal's a bad word in South Africa, by the way, as it often is here. The English-speaking people are usually called liberals, and the Afrikaans people are usually called conservative. The liberal people hope for change and are against apartheid, but they hope for changing white people. They hope to make a white system better. And the black person who told me this, he said, when a person begins to hope, place one's hope in the leadership and the success of the liberation movement of black people, and place one's hope for the future of South Africa in the black government of South Africa, the black majority government of South Africa, and places one's solidarity with the demolishing and the dismantling of the apartheid system, totally, publicly, and unequivocally, and places one hope in the creation of the new government led by the black majority of South Africa, then one can become a trusted relationship with the struggle in South Africa. Well, we have to stop. Is that, Bill, stop it. I thought it went. It's, Right. Oh, that's a lunch bell. And it's on that basis, and you can read that, and I have one other thing I'd like to give you before you can take before you leave, and that is another statement of the coalition trying to describe our belief on that our first step in order to be in solidarity with our Christian brothers and sisters and with the way change is happening in South Africa is to get out of the investment business in South Africa in order to open up new doors for change in other directions, not as a one-shot deal, but in order to open up new doors for working in other ways.